So agenda paper two. Agenda paper two includes the submissions, the rest of the submissions that we have received for this meeting. I think all of you are quite familiar with how it works. We do not intend to discuss every topic there, but you're welcome to ask any questions or express any views on any of the topics included in there. I think because this is quite a big paper this time, first I will talk, or you will reflect your comments or questions on topics until page 10, and then we'll do the rest, just so we would not go back and forth between topics, if that's okay. So if you have any observations on topics included until and including page 10, that would be a good time.
Chance. Leslie is out. Somebody could be first.
So you open it for page 38.
So we have to wait for Leslie.
I'll give her a chance to go back.
Oh, Zelly.
Okay.
Where page 10, sorry?
Yeah, why is 10?
We're just going to do it on steps. We're going to do it up to page 10.
After page 10.
So if you have anything until page 10, that would be the right time to...
Sophie, guys, we need to...
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
I'm far more than
page 10. So okay. I think that the paper brings some clarification on some topics. For instance, the S-98 exercising an option included within the contract, or definition of a portfolio when determined as a boundary of contract. I have a concern with page 10, the S-106, the assessing portfolios. In fact, you refer to IS-8, and you say that we should be consistent and we should apply consistent policies for similar portfolios. I would like to know what you intend by the wording similar portfolios, because I agree that IS-8 says that we need to apply consistent policies for similar transactions. However, when we have a specific IFRS that deals with this specific question, and it is the case with IFRS 17, we could have an exemption, and with IFRS 17 on B129, it is written that we can choose to apply the OCI option, and the choice is done portfolio by portfolio. And I think it's correct to do that, because this choice depends a lot on the way we recognize and we classify the assets.
Yes.
And so depending on the classification, fair value through P&L or fair value through OCI, we will have a different policy. So when you speak about similar portfolios, do you take into account the fact that a portfolio cannot be similar because the assets are recognized differently?
Yes, that's correct. That is a helpful clarification. The actual requirements talk about portfolio when considering the assets that you manage. So they could be different because of the assets, and that's fair. That it was not intended to change that. So thank you for that.
Yep.
Sergio?
Just want to make a quick comment on S86 on page 3. I think that confirmation of the definition of portfolio is very helpful. It's consistency across the different paragraph here, paragraph 14 and 34, and in the appendix there. It's really important and very helpful.
Gail?
Just on S96 and S107 on page 5, I just want to be clear, the response there that refers to B24, I think we need to be careful, because B24 has two sorts of options, ones that are where the price is set and one where the price that isn't set. And so some people might get confused who aren't familiar with it. So I think you're talking about
one of those two.
Yes, that's correct.
Francesco.
Submission 98. I would like to comment that I don't see the words of the standard to be so clear to actually help deal with this submission, and the point that leads me
uncomfortable is when you have this deferred annuity contract that is effectively using a specified pool of underlying assets, et cetera, and therefore can meet the definition because it's for next 50 years. But then you end up at the point where the annuitization option is exercised and the underlying items disappear. It would have been better, in my opinion, to discuss it because that is actually not so clear in the standard as to what you're going to do, given that once you are in VFA, you cannot get out of VFA accounting unless there is a modification under paragraph 72, and the exercise of an option is not one of those conditions. So the absence of the underlying items would have been a better topic for discussion rather than to leave it to us to work out, because I don't think the standard is clear at all. So I, unfortunately, I wouldn't agree with the staff conclusion that this submission 98 was one that the standard can deal just by reading it.
The submission did not ask how to account in circumstances that you no longer have underlying items or they are no longer identified, and how you would apply the VFA approach in these circumstances. They were actually asking about something that we have discussed many times in the past, about exercising an option within the contract boundary, whether it can be looked at as a modification. And the standard is 100% clear on this, that it's not. So this is why it is included here. I think your question is quite valid, but it was not. It's not around this.
It's clearer now than when it was written.
Yeah,
there.
I understand. It's really sometimes it's really difficult to read more to what we've
thank
got
you for
here,
the clarification. But that's
okay. Thank you. So anything else until 10, or should we go? So okay. So if you have any questions or comments on submissions between page 11, let's say, until page 21.
Yes, I have a concern on S144, change in the fair value of underlying items applying the VFA.
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
As the S144.
114.
Change in the fair value of underlying items applying the VFA.
Okay, so
my concern is regarding the presentation. You know, when we disaggregate and when we use the OCI option, if we are just investment assets, so for me, in fact, the net investment result should be nil at the end. Even if we have other underlying assets that are not invested assets, like expense or technical items, I think that the effect and the impact of the disaggregation should not be posted in the investment result. It should be posted in the item of the P&L that relate to the underlying items, for instance, insurance results, because otherwise we will have an investment results that will be not nil. And I think it should be very strange to include in it some impact related to mortality or things like that.
Yes, I understand this. And if you don't mind, Sophie, I think it relates very much to a topic that we have in the next section, which I know some of you also raised with me at least. So we can talk about it all at the same time in just a few minutes. So if there's anything on the other topics before we move on to the next.
Sally.
My comment on S117. Some people think it's a different conclusion from what we discussed in September. So I think we just need to clarify for the premium waiver what it should be treated, because quite a few people think it's different from the conclusion from September's TIG meeting.
September TIG meeting was discussing whether a premium waiver is an insured event. And the conclusion of this discussion was that in those circumstances, when we discussed, I think it was a disability. Yes, it was an insured event, so it is a claim. We did not discuss at the time, although some of you may have views, but there was no analysis, nothing that talks about the presentation in the P&L. Now, so it couldn't be that we have a different conclusion because it was not formally discussed. Now we actually got the follow-up question of what does it mean? So we know we have a claim when we have a waiver. What does it mean for the presentation in the P&L? And we said that a gross presentation seemed to be consistent with the requirements of the standard because there is a claim. So if you have a claim, you have a cost of claim, you have also that premium. So was this what you read to what we said here, or is that okay?
It actually means that you should be claim and premium.
So what we say here, that if you have a premium and a claim at the same amount that net to zero, it seems to be consistent with the requirements of the standard, given that we said that a waiver is a claim. Okay. Is this where you are, or you are in a different place?
Yeah, because probably we understand different from the last TIG meeting.
Okay, no, that's fine. I understand this.
Okay, Leslie?
I have a comment on S118 on page 17, and I wanted to express appreciation for the staff view and the example, but I also wanted to clarify that the example given is not necessarily the only way to go about this. It depends on the entity's view of the consideration required, including reinsurance. So I think when I read the example, I was confused at the table. I got to the same result I would have gotten to in the end, but via a different route. And I just wanted to clarify that it's not necessarily the cost of the reinsurance that determines the compensation the entity requires for offloading the risk. We may have different approaches to getting there.
So I'm happy to hear that you got to the same numbers. I feel much better now.
What I think is important
is always when we give example, people are worried that we are narrowing things down. But there is no way to be helpful without sometimes giving an example. What I think is the takeaway from that example, which is very important, that if you consider your insurance when you determine your risk adjustment for your issued contracts, when you consider its existence, you need to consider the cost of this reinsurance, not just the benefit. And this is what we were trying to bring out in that example. That's it. And if you picked up, that's fine.
I think you widened my perception of what the possible ways of looking at this are, but I would have to then look to what the entity's view of
which
of
is
that
the, always the case
is.
With risk adjustment.
Good.
Yeah,
Leslie,
I agree. Yeah.
Okay,
I agree with Leslie.
Good.
Yeah.
Gail.
I've forgotten. Which page are we up to? Sorry.
We are 10 to 21.
21. Okay, 1, 2, 5. Okay, I've got three comments. So my first comment was on S122, which was the inflation one. And I think it's just the way some people may be reading the response there. So when I think about, and we have had debates on this internally within PwC, because inflation is used in many different ways. So you may have a payment going out to policyholders that are clearly tied contractually into an index, and I would agree that that is a financial and the conclusion. The slight concern was with the very last sentence, because other places where inflation is used is people are trying to anticipate their future expense base to put into their fulfillment cash flows, and they may use an inflation index to build in their expectation that salaries will go up over time. They did not see that as being that linkage there being a financial that they needed to pull out. And some people have read the last sentence about cash flows that an entity expects to increase with an index are considered to be financial risks, as then saying those would need to be pulled out, which I don't think is what actuaries were currently anticipating to do. So that was my first one. My second one was on S115, which was the VFA one. I thought this and the example were extremely helpful, because I have heard numerous discussions on how to do this for the B101 test. So I think this was extremely helpful. The one thing I think it may be helpful is I think there is still not unanimous view or understanding of how you do the conclusion, the B101C test, as I call the variability. And I do wonder whether having an example, and clearly example two doesn't go on to do that, might be helpful to create consistency, because I think people are not yet quite clear what the 101C test is. But I agree with what's written there. And my last one was on S119, which was the reinsurance risk adjustment for the non-performance of reinsurer. I have heard people reading the response in different ways, so I would welcome the staff's conclusions to what that says. So I had read this as saying your risk adjustment can't take into account the risk of non-payment by reinsurer because it's not a risk being transferred in the first paragraph, which we would agree with. The second paragraph that refers to paragraph 63, I personally had read that as saying within your fulfillment cash flows, you will build in the probability weighting of non-performance of your reinsurer. Some people believe that then you can, because of paragraph 63, you can still put that into your risk adjustment. And I don't know whether that was or wasn't intended, but people are reading it both ways. So
I thought that we were clear that the risk adjustment is the risk being transferred. Mm-hmm. Nothing is in there should reflect the non-performance. The standard has been very explicit that everything that relates to non-performance should be part of present value, discounted present value.
Okay, thanks, Massimo.
I would like just to underline the point already mentioned. So S118, S119, I think they are very useful for clarification in the discussion of the risk adjustments and also in the link and how to link direct contract and reinsurance in case of non-proportional. And so the fact that in the risk adjustment you should consider if this is the practice that the entity is doing in pricing its direct contract. I agree that, let's say, on the example, maybe this is a way to represent a possible effect to measure that, but it's strictly related on the relation between the reinsurance structure and the underlying contracts. So considering the risk adjustment is one of the areas where there is the judgment of the entity, I think it's very important to underline that this is one exemplification on how you can do that, but according to the link between underlying contract and reinsurance structure, you may have a different approach consistent with the fact that you should reflect in the risk adjustment of the reinsurance your insurance strategy if this is part of how you are looking at the compensation from non-financial risk.
As long as you reflect the cost of reinsurance as well, which was our main point, not to tell you how to calculate the risk adjustment because it is an entity specific.
Very.
So I have a question on S115, which I would like to ask to make sure that I'm reading the response correctly. So that's S115 on page 14.
Yes.
I'm actually going to do it in reverse order. So again, it's like lots of these questions. It's a multi-part question. And the second part of the question, which is buried right down at the bottom of the left-hand side of the page, asks about how to treat the premium for the mortality cover. And that your response on that point is that that is a payment for an insurance service, and that does not come into our consideration of 101B. And that's an important point, I think, for many unit-linked contracts. I would just like to clarify
that. I cannot clarify everything for all unit-linked contracts. For this submission, we got an example when there is a mortality charge, as you've seen in the example, a mortality charge that is deducted from the asset account at the beginning of each period. And we said, yes, in this example, this is actually does not interfere with the sharing of the returns between the policyholder and the entity. The policyholder, in effect, took his return and then used it to buy a mortality coverage. So I don't know if you have other fact patterns in mind. We always have to be very careful with this, but here I think we feel quite comfortable. So
that is helpful. But on the other hand, and I'm going to come back to the first part of the question, because in this case, the asset management fee is determined as a percentage of the fair value of the underlying items, that does then change the sharing percentages.
Yes.
And the thing that is important here is that percentage of the fair value, because there could be other charging mechanisms.
This is why it is variable.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it is why I do absolutely accept Okay. That it now feels as though there's an almost infinity of these contract variations, and I do absolutely accept you can't respond in every case. But that's helpful clarification. Thank you.
Anne?
Thank you. I can start with 116. Just the last paragraph in the response. It was very helpful to note that the reinsurance contracts held for underlying insurance contracts are still being discussed. For general insurers, this issue of the reinsurance contracts held and how they respond to onerous underlying contracts for non-proportionate reinsurance is still a big issue. The previous staff proposed changes in January dealt with the proportionate, but this is still a big issue for general insurers. So good to note. My comment was basically it's good to know that this is still being discussed now, albeit through a process other than here. On 118, I'll just echo what some of the others had said around the risk adjustment. This was actually extremely helpful to see it clarified that when determining the compensation for bearing the uncertainty, you would take into account the reinsurance. It was also helpful to have it clarified that took into account both the cost and the benefit. But to echo what Leslie and Massimo have said, this is not the only way to do it. I mean, obviously, it's an example, so by definition, it's quite simplified. I wouldn't say that we all came up with the same answer.
So you need to sit together and work out your problems.
I think we probably come up with a few potential different ways of doing this, but to the point that it's the way the entity would look at reinsurance is very important because that can make a difference to this. Anyway, but so that was really good to see. And I think just one final point was on 122, and this was a question around expense cash flows. But I just want to caution here, obviously in a general insurance world, your inflation around your premiums and your expenses might be relatively minor, insignificant, but when you're looking at your claims reserving, clearly there can be times when you're looking at inflationary components and when you're not. So where things are directly based on an index, perhaps that's where you pull it out and treat it as a separate financial risk. But for most part, when you're doing claims reserving, it's just perhaps one of many different components you look at, such things as superimposed inflation, which relate to no index, but your view of what's likely to happen in that portfolio in that jurisdiction. So I think we've just got to be mindful that we shouldn't be dragging anything out of the claims reserving process for general insurers, which is trying to identify inflation when it's not really there, mm-hmm. or it's just a very small component part.
Francesco.
Thank you. I have 3 points. I'll start actually from 1 to 2, the one that Leslie just commented. So Leslie, Anne just commented. The way I read the standard, and I was a bit surprised by this comment, because it seems to be covering more than I anticipated in terms of taking this inflation out of the fulfillment cash flow mechanism, is that I need to find something in the contract that the policyholder needs to know that the cash flows are linked to an inflation index. That to me would be an example where that becomes an assumption that is financial in nature, so I don't unlock my CSM. But if I do it in the context of a claim, for example, and I just use that for convenience, that's an assumption that I use to effectively project forward an increase in my labor cost or whatever it is. I didn't see that as something that the standard would actually catch as a financial variable, and I still look at that as an insurance expense element. Now, in a claim liability, there is no CSM, but when I read that, I felt that we were going to be called out in terms of variables that are financials more than I was anticipating, and I wanted to share that reaction on that particular point. The next one is on submission 115. Others have commented already about it. I wanted to ask, is the submission, effectively, like in the example, only talking about a mortality charge, which is a fixed amount?
We reflected in that so paper what we received in the submission. It was a fixed mortality.
So there was no reference about mortality charges being in charge through a basis point.
I don't remember all the details, but I think the focus was there with a fixed mortality charge.
It was a fixed mortality.
It was, right? Yeah. I don't know if there was some footnote or something. I can't remember from the top of my head, but the example was with a fixed mortality charge.
Obviously, it's not a fact pattern then in the submission, but mortality charges are not necessarily fixed amounts only. In fact, they can be often done through basis point charges. And I was concerned that the description and the response that you put against that effectively allows a contractual determination that is effectively totally under the control of the issuer of the contract to have some very important implications on the classification of the contract under IFRS 17. And I can see a risk of structuring emerging as a result of the total charge being what the issuer wants to receive from the customer for both investment services and the standard rate obligation, but then to effectively decompose them in the legal form of the contract such that the mortality component of the charge is as high as possible. And that really makes me nervous about this.
What would you do, Francesco, in this case?
I don't want to disrupt the comfort that people are receiving from the response, because they seem to be all happy with it. So I don't want to be the contrarian here, but I don't see a basis in the standard as it is written to actually look through what I'm charging for. There is a share that I'm going to get from the return, and if I don't get it, I don't get it. I don't see, again, a gross share of the returns that I get, and then I need to give some money back to the insurance company because I'm buying something else. That is clear now in the response, but I wouldn't have got there myself by reading what you've written in the standard.
So that's
a mission to follow that. So.
Yeah, I think that submission, again, was about fixed mortality charge. I think you raised a different fact pattern when we have a variable mortality charge.
Technically, also with the fixed, I think you can concern, do the same with the fixed. Then.
Yeah, I think your concern emphasized that sometimes look through is very important to understand the substance of the arrangement, because we know what is the substance of the arrangement of a variable fee approach. So I think it's an helpful observation. But this submission and the answer that we have here is limited to what we receive. But I think it's helpful observation. And sometimes you need to do a bit more and to look through and understand what is going on.
The only objective measure of the mortality would be to look at the alpha, because that's undeniable. You've got to pay mortality benefits when they happen. And that cannot be tempered by effectively determining how much fee will be allocated against that versus the investment management service. But that's not what is written in the response.
Because it was not what's written in the submission. But I'll pick up your observation, because I think it will be helpful in analyzing other cases. So I think it's good. Thank you.
And then the last one is a bit in between submission 118 and 119, in the sense that it comes from 118, but then it deals with the credit risk of the insurance company. The issue is, if I read correctly the response in submission 118, then when a cedent effectively measures the risk adjustment for the issued contracts, the liability, they may actually have a compensation approach that takes into account purchased reinsurance, and so their risk adjustment liability would be a smaller amount than if their compensation was not taking into account the protection of reinsurance purchased. And that company may be acquired by another 1 year later, and the risk management of the new group is different. And they say, now we've got to change. So the same calculation that was done last year when they were owned by Group A, they're now going to be changed, because Group B says, actually, the consideration for risk that we use in this group is not to take into account reinsurance protection. So at that point, I stop calculating my risk adjustment liability, and I start calculating a risk adjustment liability which is without consideration of the insurance, but I do have reinsurance, so now my risk adjustment in the insurance held goes up. That seems to be the logical conclusion of what comes from 118. The other problem that this in response creates is that, let's say that I have to measure the credit risk on the reinsurance company, and I was unfortunate, and one of my reinsurers has gone completely insolvent, so I have to write off the amount. It's not certain, so I have to use the expected incurred loss, expected loss basis. So that becomes effectively an adjustment. I heard Andrea saying that you need to do that in the measurement of the cash flows, but I think that the standard in paragraph 67 talks about fulfillment cash flows, which are defined as the estimate of the cash flows and the risk adjustment. So also the risk adjustment should be subject to the same impairment, but in 1 year, I got if this insolvency was happening in the year where I was calculating my risk adjustment net of insurance, I would book a loss which is smaller than if I was going to do the same the following year, because now I got the risk adjustment for the reinsurance held visible in the financial statements. So the question then is, if 118 is the way to do it, how do we deal with the credit risk of the insurer if that is actually part of the risk adjustment liability in the first place?
Without dragging us to a very technical discussion, which we have not prepared for, I can say two things. First of all, for your first question, which is about group accounting and risk adjustment, we've been there with the discussion about subsidiary and group accounting for the risk adjustment, whether it's changed when you go a higher level. I don't think we want to go there again.
No, the board has discussed it,
so
it's not that.
Nothing in S18 is there.
I was not referring to that, though.
So it's about the current measurement of the risk adjustment.
That's the policy of the entity,
yes.
Not the group.
The other thing that I want to point out is that when you consider reinsurance in determining the risk adjustment for your issued contracts, you're considering the existence of the reinsurance or the availability of reinsurance facility, not necessarily you take the amount that you pay for a specific reinsurance contract into that determination, because it means that you will have a risk adjustment which is a net on the gross. This is not where we are. So I think we need to distinguish between. So if a reinsurer, the one that you used to work with, goes bust, it does not necessarily mean anything about the risk adjustment for the contracts that you have been issued. It's the availability of reinsurance. So I think we should distinguish between the two. Again, I do not know if you want to go that far. This paper, all it says that if you consider the existence of reinsurance facilities when you determine the amount of the compensation that you require to bear the risk, you should consider this in determining the risk adjustment. We have one example to illustrate this that needs to emphasize that you consider the cost, but it doesn't go as far in the analysis as you did. So, Terrell, did you want to
react? Just thinking, I think it's probably worth saying that if you have a habit of using shaky reinsurers, then clearly one of the things you think about, yes, when you are looking at the compensation you require is the fact that you are introducing this credit risk in you need to be thinking about that as part of the whole.
By the way, if this is a habit of yours, it will be reflected in the cost of reinsurance, which will be low, and then you'll have. So it really depends on when you are, but.
And also, I would agree with you. I think the whole issue of acquisition accounting, I think, plays into that TRG decision we've talked about before, and specifically talks about the compensation you're getting for taking on that additional business. So I think that's a whole new thing to think about.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe.
Thank you, Matthew. I just want to quickly comment on 115. I want to thank you for the clarification, especially the example, which is very helpful. It provides clarity. Just want to add on to what was said earlier, because there are so many different charges in an insurance contract. Yeah. The way I look at this is that the charges that are not directly linked to the fair value returns of the underlying items, in this example, the mortality charge, which is a fix, yeah. Those are considered amount payout of the policy to the share. So I think that is important.
Thank you.
Next is I want to make one comment on S121. Here the response, go back to paragraph B125 of the standard, that say, you know, this should be done in a systematic way on the basis of passage of time. I just want to comment that, you know, it's important to note the word systematic way. It doesn't necessarily mean a straight line, because some people automatically equate the passage of time to a straight line. If that's the case, you know, B125 should just say passage of time, yeah, without mentioning systematic way. You know, straight line could be one of the systematic way, yeah, but then not necessarily the only one. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Jo.
Thank you. Yeah, on reinsurance, I think it's helpful to clarify the point about the risk adjustment. So on 118, on the example, I just thought it was worth mentioning that we discussed this at length and we came to a different answer. So I think we agreed with the first table that, and the second table, how the risk adjustment was built up, that it moves from 30 to 25 in total. Then on the last table, we felt that the risk adjustment there, that should be 10. We weren't taking a 50-50 split, because our view is if you've laid off a portion, the risk adjustment for the portion you've laid off is, it should be the net amount plus the cost of the reinsurance. And therefore, when you look at it, that on that last table, instead of 12.5, we didn't think it was a straight 50-50. We thought that should have been the 10. So I suppose it seems like there is different ways of looking at it, and you know, people came to different answers.
I just want to emphasize something in this regard, because I heard this comment in the past, and then I know that there are different ways in practice to determine the net amount sometimes, or the net or the reinsurance held amount. So there is the gross minus net equals the reinsurance transfer. But the way that the standard is looking at is that you need to determine the risk adjustment for your gross, so for your contract that you've issued in the standard language, and you need to go specifically to measure the amount of risk adjustment of the reinsurance held. And this what equals your net, and this is the amount that it is transferred. And we looked at the risk adjustment that we have, which is 25, and you've transferred 50% of it, so you get to 20 to 12 and a half. This is not equal to a situation that you would calculate your net amount as like only what you have in 50%, and then you determine the reinsurance to be 10. I think when you say different ways of calculating, yes, there are different ways to calculate the risk adjustment, but we don't mean net. The risk adjustment for reinsurance contract held is the risk of being transferred, so that should be clear.
I think we have we've kept the 25. We've kept risk of 15, and we've transferred risk with a risk adjustment of 10. So yeah, I think it's a different perspective.
Okay, Leslie.
Just a quick comment on the inflation one. When I read this, I did not think it was bringing more into financial risk because of the words "the entity expects to increase with an index." I think you could consider it financial risk if you did link your cash flows to the actual index. But you don't need to do that. You can just say, you know, you can identify your cash flows a different way. So I would just say on this one, be careful how your actuary expresses the assumptions. The standard clearly says inflation can be a financial risk, but need not be a financial risk.
Yeah, I just didn't think it was clear.
I didn't think it was a good idea to actually just tell them to rewrite the notes when they were never. There was nothing in the contract that actually tells there is an inflation linkage there. It's just a convenient. So
just be careful. Is all
I am being careful, and, and okay, that's why Sophie. I said the comment.
Yes, I had also a comment on the inflation. I consider that for PNC contract, it should never be considered as financial risk. And for the eligibility to the VFA contracts, page 14, I agree that in some we need in some cases to do calculations, but in the response done, there is a feeling we are obliged to do a calculation. I think it should be clear that in some cases, a quantitative a qualitative assessment is sufficient.
Well, thanks. So, going to the last page.
Yeah, so any comments or questions on everything else is now the time.
Okay. Thank you, Martin. I just want here two clarities. One is on S92 on page 31, which is about the accounting treatment for power shortage dividends of a participating contract that apply the general model, assuming that that contract fails the criteria for variable fees model owing to the significant part of the insurance list. According to the responses, the staff said changes in cash flows that result from the underlying item, which is the entity's profit, should be treated as changes in financial risk. I really appreciate such a clear response on that. Initially, I thought changes in policyholder dividends cash flows should be accounted for respectively based on the sources of earnings. But I'm very hopeful for these decisions made. And that's my first comment. And my next point that I want to clarify with the staff is the response given on here on S111, which is accounting for the risk reinstatement of lapsed contract. Most Korean insurers now know, under statutory accounting principle, currently classify a lapsed contract as liability for incurred claims when the contract is lapsed. For your information, Korean insurers are now measuring insurance liabilities based on net premium reserve, which is cost-basis accounting. But under IFRS 17, which introduced the fair value concept, I think that according to the definition of liability for remaining coverage, cash flows related to the unexpired portion of the coverage period, such as the expected reinstatement, should be part of the liability for remaining coverage. This is, I think, a very simple logic in the fair value concept, but there are still many preparers out there who don't understand exactly with only responses given in this paper. So in that sense, would you please clarify on this?
I think that the answer here is quite clear.
Pretty clear to me.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Rachel?
One quick comment on S109 on page 26. The topics mentioned group insurance policy. The questions here mentioned agenda paper 8 of TRG meeting. That's fine. The one that I have a problem is agenda paper 3 of the September TRG meeting. Yeah. So that paper is only for reinsurance contract. You look at the fact patterns discussed in the paper and also the meeting summary. The context is about reinsurance contracts, yeah, not group insurance policy.
So for this one, I guess we had a catch up on this before. I do not want to revisit our discussion at the September meeting. The submissions there were about reinsurance commissions, but what we've done is we looked at the economic substance of the exchanges and amount, asking ourselves whether it is a claim or it isn't a claim. And I think that economic substance assessment is relevant to other insurance contracts as well, and we said that in the last meeting. I don't think it relates to anything in S101 or 09, so I do not want to revisit us.
Francesco.
Okay, my one comment only on the three submissions, 101, 120, 124 on page 32. I So the response is clear, but I was surprised to read that response because if I'm reading it correctly, this seems to say that presentation choices will create a different CSM measurement as a result of the option to present the portion of the change in risk adjustment as financial or not. And that is something that surprises me significantly. And I actually tried to see whether there is a logic in the standard that actually justifies that, and I couldn't find it. So I find myself at odds with this response. I noticed that there is a plan to clarify in the annual improvement areas around this topic. I just want to confirm that my concern would allow me to comment in that area, whether it's going to be effectively something else rather than what I just said that will be included in the annual improvement.
Thank you. We've noted this also. I think we've noted our intention of what we're going to do. We do think that if you choose, and it is a choice, to disaggregate your risk adjustment, it was not required because a lot of people said that it is difficult, so the standard does not require. If you do do this disaggregation, you need to do it consistently throughout, including the CSM. This is the way that we proposed the board to continue on this, and there would be a board discussion, so I'll pick that input as well.
Roman.
Yeah, thank you. On 92, page 31, I think that was already referenced by Sophie earlier, that this is a submission on a general model, but then I read also the staff paper for the April board meeting 2D, paragraph 14 and 15, where then proposed amendment is discussed in connection with this submission, which I think is also on the response already indicated. So I was surprised about that conclusion. I think the conclusion in the board paper is in general, not only for the general model, but also valid then for the variable fee approach, that you say whatever comes from an underlying item is a financial risk. And I think rightfully it's rightfully stated here that underlying items can not only be financial assets or investments, but there can be other profit sources, I would call it, which are creating underlying items under specific contracts. And in the German market, but also in the Swiss and Austrian market, where we have usually in the life insurance business profit sharing from all profit sources, so investments, technical result, but also cost result, people and preparers, but also auditors, were of the opinion that the different profit sources would also result then in the different line items, even if they're underlying items and they represent not all financial risk. Now, I think with this proposed amendment, you would say that if I have a mortality experience, for example, that would be a financial risk leading then to experience in the insurance service result, which is counterbalanced with an entry in the investment result, netting then out again to zero, so the ultimate P&L net income is not impacted. But I believe that would be a kind of distortion of the picture, because it would indicate that you have an investment result which is impacted by mortality risk, because you say an underlying all what comes from underlying item is financial risk. So I believe that the separation is more meaningful, and we were prepared to disclose separately the impact from the different profit sources in the different line items. That is something which I think so far was not foreseen in implementation and could impair somehow the also the presentation and the way what a reader can get out of it. And I'm a bit surprised that mortality risk is financial risk, because the mortality risk is shared with the whenever the mortality risk is shared with the policyholder. That is a logic I do not fully understand.
Okay, so I might react to this, and then Sophie also mentioned this as well. So the submission that we have received is an example of a general model contract, mm-hmm. and in the general model contract there is underlying items that could happen, and the underlying items have insurance as well. And they ask whether they need to look through the underlying items and identify the changes that come from financial assumptions for the investments that they have and the changes that they have for the insurance contract, the non-financial one, and actually adjust the CSM in the general model because they unbundle and look at the different sources of changes. And we said, no, definitely. In the general model, we do not adjust the CSM for changes in underlying item. This is why we felt it's necessary to take this to an AIP to clarify that the board never intended that in the general model, you would adjust the CSM for changes in underlying items. And this is because, at least for us, we look at the changes in the underlying items as financial. This is not something that would adjust the CSM in the general model. And I don't think you disagree with this, because I don't think your implementation plan would adjust the CSM in the general model.
No.
So I think we're fine with that, and this is what we're going to do next week with the board. I think your observations relate to the presentation.
Yes.
So I understand this, and I think that we can pick that up as we prepare for the board discussion. But it is necessary to clarify in an AIP, you do not adjust the CSM for the changes. My opinion is that it should be looked as financial, but I understand there are other views there. So we will pick that feedback to the board discussion.
And if you're allowed to amend, Martin, I agree it's a presentation topic only within the variable fee approach, only that to the term financial risk, a lot of things are somehow linked to the financial risk. It's about risk mitigation, different things. So yes. At the moment, I must say, I don't have the full picture. What could be the implications if we say all underlying items are financial risk? There could be far-reaching implications I don't see, so I think that should be beside that. I see a distortion in the way we present our result between underwriting result and investment result. There might be other implications which should be thought through, so I'm a little bit nervous on this conclusion, underlying items equal financial risk.
Gail?
Thank you, Martin. I'm conscious of time. I'm sorry, I missed one earlier. S123, which was the reassessment of the premium allocation approach. I don't disagree with that, but I think we have come across, there are a lot of cases in the standards where there are elections, and this is one of them. And I'm not always sure it's clear when an election is a policy, something other than an accounting policy, an estimate, and then when IS8 applies prospectively or retrospectively. So I don't disagree with what's here, but I think there's a lot of other questions that are kind of, I think there's a lack of clarity.
Should I try to summarize? So obviously we cannot capture in the summary over 40 items, but I think I've heard from you that there's a lot of helpful clarifications that are included in this paper. You've noted a few things. So I think for the inflation point, some of you looked at our answer different than what they have expected. They would expect that there would need to be a contractual leak, but the standard says based on. So there was maybe a different expectation there. So this is one point. The other point I think that Francesca mentioned, which I think is very helpful, when we talked about the VFA scope, our example is limited to a mortality charge that is fixed. And if it is variable, it may be helpful to look through deeper into the arrangement to determine whether you meet the VFA scope considering the VFA objective. So I thought it's another helpful observation. Another thing that we discussed is about risk adjustment, determining the risk adjustment when we have reinsurance. Again, risk adjustment is always an entity specific. We have an example to help, but the key messages there that I don't want us to lose is that when you do this consideration, you need to consider the cost of reinsurance. And when you determine the risk adjustment for the reinsurance held, you need to consider that it's the risk adjustment that is the risk that is transferred rather than anything else. So I think it's the word the words are in the standard, but it's helpful to note. So those three things are helpful clarifications. There are two things that relates to our proposed AIP. So one of them is related to the underlying items. So I think we're all comfortable that in the general model, it should be clear that you do not adjust the CSM for changes in the underlying items. Some of you have concerns whether about the impact on the presentation in the profit or loss. So this is something that we will feed back to the board in that discussion. And I think Francesco's point about the disaggregation of the risk adjustment for financial and non-financial component, I think our proposal is that if you choose to do this disaggregation, you need to consider that disaggregation throughout, including how you adjust the CSM. And this is different than what some of us were expecting. So it's an observation that we will feed back to the board discussion. And I think I picked up the things that are helpful for our stakeholders, unless there's anything else.
Good. No.